Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. The speaker is Paula. Our home group is Doorkeepers in Newark, Delaware.
I hope you guys don't mind. I fell 2 weeks ago, and so I'm going to have to lean on the podium. My ankle's really sore. And I've got my coat on because I have a combination of terrified, hot, and freezing cold. So anyhow, my name's Paula Gurmak. I'm an alcoholic. And hi, everybody. And it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not a pleasure standing up front. But it is an honor to be asked to stand up here. I'm hoping God kicks in fairly soon. I did do my little prayer in the bathroom. I like to just kneel down on the bathroom floor and say, God, you know, please remove me out of the way. And let me say something that will bear witness to his power. And it hasn't happened yet, so... My sobriety date is January 1st, 1997, and I do have a home group, and it's the Doorkeepers, and it's a woman's big book group, and I always say this because it's the truth. I'm not one to really like the special interest groups. I don't like the gay groups, the men groups, the women groups, the pilot groups, and yet I'm in a woman's big book group. So... In our area, I hang around a lot of women that are really young and really pretty. And everywhere we go, guys are always hitting up on them. And about 2 years ago, they came up with the idea they wanted to be in a woman's group away from men so they could help other women. And I was like, oh, no, you don't get it. I'm traditional. We can't do that. I don't do that kind of stuff. But it isn't all about me. And so... I just agreed to it. It seemed like a good idea. A lot of times people will come up and say, oh, what are you doing in a woman's group? And, you know, that kind of thing. But that's the story behind why we have a woman's big book group. The other thing that's kind of neat, I don't know if anybody knows the reference to the Doorkeepers. I hope you don't mind rambling a little bit, but that helps me. The Doorkeepers is actually, it's the name of an Oxford group poem, and our society, as you, I'm sure this group knows, comes from the Oxford movement, and the Reverend Shoemaker was one of the leaders of it, at least the New York contingent, and he actually wrote this beautiful poem that's called I Stand by the Door. And you know, I don't know about you guys, but when I used to come in an AA meeting, I certainly didn't stand by any door. I ran in. It was all about me. I was always hoping I looked good. My makeup was on right, and who would see me, and, you know, for all the wrong reasons. And this poem, the Doorkeeper poem, or verse, or whatever, prayer, or whatever you want to call it, talks about the importance of standing at the door to a society like this, because there are people outside of that door, dying, terrified, in the dark, without any hope, without any light in their eyes. And us, the people in the rooms that have seen the light, have a way of living, need to stand at that door to help pull them into the rooms. So, you know, that should tell you about fellowshipping, right? The idea of, should we be in here fellowshipping, or should we be standing at that door pulling those people out of the dark? And if it wasn't for somebody pulling me into the room and offering me the steps, I'm sure I wouldn't be where I am today, which is the blessed person of having a spiritual awakening, benefiting from a relationship with God through good sponsorship. And that wasn't my story when I first came in. And I'll tell you about that, but just briefly, I don't want to do a big long drunkalogue. Sometimes I get carried away with it, you know, because I think I'm so funny and I think I'm so cute, and you're just gonna love my story. But my story's not all that interesting, is what I have found out, especially because I work with so many women and they've got some stories. I'll share my story with you a little bit, but probably one of the the biggest impact I ever, I had a pretty big awakening when I sat with a girl and she told me that as a newborn child, her mother took her with the umbilical cord still on her and left her in a field. And I used to think my story was so interesting. How you like to come into Alcoholics Anonymous with a story like that? And so that has always helped me when I know that other stories are out there like that, and these women are staying sober and helping others and don't fall into self-pity. And that's the kind of stuff that I draw from. And it's only as a result of being active, you know, I only get to hear that kind of stuff because I'm helping people. And so anytime I think my story's so funny or I'm so interesting or I'm so unique, I think about some of the stories that have been shared with me. I don't think I've ever heard anybody tell a story like that before. It broke my heart. And yet this woman had a light in her eye and in her eyes, and she was accepting of it, and she had a relationship with the power. And I don't know. But anyhow, I know I've had that spiritual malady all my life, and I know that I've been an untreated alcoholic all my life, and I know that it started before I took a drink, and I also feel in my heart that it has nothing to do with taking a drink. And I know that might sound controversial sometimes, because a lot of times we talk about that physical allergy and we beat that to death. But what this alcoholic remembers is what I felt like as a child, where I never felt like I fit in. You know, that's alcoholism, where my perceptions weren't quite right, where I didn't know how to deal with life, where I always thought about me and never thought about you. And I always thought that the fix was on the outside. So, you know, I thought if I was taller, I'd be okay. If my father was the professor, like the professor that lived down the street, not the assembly worker, you know, I would be okay. And this is the kind of thoughts I had just from childhood. Twiggy was real popular then. I always like to tell people she has real thin lips and real tall, and I thought, well, if I was real tall and had real thin lips, I would be okay. So I was looking for something. I was definitely looking for something. And that's alcoholism. That's how it's been explained to me. That's that emptiness inside, that malady. I suffered from that malady early on, and it manifested itself in the form of many forms of fears. I was diagnosed as being very shy, but now what I know is I thought about myself a lot, and I had real self-centered fear, and that was untreated alcoholism. I really needed to take that drink. I really needed to take that drink, and I remember when I took that drink and the relief it gave me. And obviously it was the wrong spirit, you know, it was the spirit of alcohol and not the real spirit that would actually fill me full love and life like I am today. But that spirit seemed attractive back then. And every time alcohol didn't work, I would do kind of a better living through chemistry thing, you know. I would try to mix it with something else or do this over here or stop this. And you know the deal. You're all alcoholics. You know what that is all about. And I did that from about 16 to 23. I crashed early, young, and quick. Do not have to take it into your 30s or 40s or 50s. I see a lot of young people today. I work with a lot of young people, like I was when I came in, and the difference between them and me is they were offered the steps and I wasn't. So they have a solution and it's filled them full. And when I came in, I came out of a 30-day facility, Hiddenbrook. I don't think it's here anymore. I know it's not. As a matter of fact, it went under. But like I said, I drank and carried on, and I actually ended up with a couple different personalities towards the end. I stayed up 24/7 so I could drink more. And so you all know what I was probably doing, is stay up around the clock 24/7. There's only a couple things I know of that will keep you going like that. And I convinced myself that that's the kind of partier I was. I used to call myself a partier. And so, you know, right before I came into that rehab, I had a couple different personalities, and I had them named, and I was hallucinating, and I was in really bad shape. For being 23, I was in really bad shape, and I was near death. And I came into that rehab, and I wasn't buying any of what they were saying. Bless you. And I remember you know, just kind of acting like the whole time I was in there, like just playing, like it was a game, like it, like my whole life was a game anyway, so this was just another game. But I do remember towards the end of that rehab, them talking about the medical definition of alcoholism, and that sold me. Back then, that sold me. I said, oh, okay, I get it. Powerless, I have this allergy to alcohol, so I probably shouldn't drink. And that's how I left the rehab, just purely and simply with the idea that from a medical scientific standpoint, I probably should not drink. And okay, I got it. I know what to do. And I really thought that, this is all hindsight, but what I thought I had fallen into with AA was a don't drink, non-drinking, allergic kind of reaction kind of club, you know, where we just sat around, our life was over, but we were keeping each other sober by going to these meetings every night. And that's what I heard. This was back in 1979, and that's what I heard everybody saying. I mean, they really did say that to me. Just keep coming back, and you need to share more. And I remember them saying that, and I remember me thinking, I am not going to share in these meetings. There's no way I'm telling these people all my personal business, like he is and she is and this one is, and you know, and that's what I saw AA was. It was like what I consider today, I don't mean to be judgmental, but more therapeutic, and that's what I fell into. And of course, in the 80s, what do we know about AA? It became extremely therapeutic, and I was on the cusp of that. So the Just Not Drink, at 23, I met a bunch of other people that were just my age, that just were not drinking, and they were all dating each other and carrying on, and we were going bowling and dancing and, you know, all this other stuff that has nothing to do with God, a higher power, or helping others. And I was basically, what I was doing was, I'm not drinking anymore, but now I got to find some other power. And it wasn't going to be God. I come in the rooms, I'm not drinking, and now I got to figure out what to do. And all about me. It's going to be all about me now. You know, I got to get more money. I married a guy that went into another rehab. He came out, he was sober, and he worked, and I spent his money. And I worked too, incidentally. And I felt kind of like empty inside, but yet I was really happy. Like I absolutely adored and loved my husband. I met him when I was about 20, so we already had about 3 years together, and three using years. Now we're, you know, in sobriety, and I absolutely got to tell you, it was the love of my life, absolutely the love of my life. And he was like my power, you know what I mean? Like I put everything into my husband, into my family. We got to get more money. So, you know, when the book talks about lack of power, that was my dilemma. Me, I'm thinking lack of all these outside things, you know, to fill that hole in my soul, that emptiness. And I kept thinking, like, something didn't feel right, so now we got to go buy something else, or we got to go take a trip. And so we're doing this, and my poor husband's working, like, 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and he's driving, like, 4 hours to a job, 4 hours back, you know, it's just crazy stuff. He had picked up a little gambling thing, so he's gambling. We got money out the yin-yang. I mean, a lot of money, a lot of gambling, a lot of shopping. I mean, you talk about, I'm selfish the whole time I'm drinking, and now I think I'm really even more selfish. Because, you know, when I was drinking, that was filling me, and I wasn't going out there doing all this other stuff. Now I just can't get enough of everything, and I'm cramming all this stuff in me, you know, this, not pills, not alcohol, just all these other powers, like false gods. Man, I wish I wish I knew what I knew, what I know today, what I knew back then, but, you know, it took all for me to lose everything to get down to just total loss again, for me to believe in another power, and that's the power of God. But anyhow, so what happened was, my husband's working a lot of hours, and our life is perfect on the outside, but both of us are feeling a little empty. He's gambling, I'm shopping. No spiritual awakening here, we're just not drinking. God had removed the obsession. God had removed the obsession, so it definitely tells you right there, you know, the number one cause of relapse isn't people, places, and things. It's sobriety. number one cause of relapsing is sobriety. You know, and that's what I had. I was sober, but that's it. I was away from alcohol, but that's it. And he was my power. And what happened was he went and got himself killed in a car accident. And that was in 1992. So I came in 79, and we're still sober and all, and he just went to work and never came back again. I had a two-year-old and a five-year-old. And well, I'm not crying. That's pretty good. See, I feel less sorry for myself. That's really good. there's a lot of stuff that happens to people. I know I don't have the market on it, but anyhow, there was the power that I had relied on, and I started getting like crazier and crazier and having panic attacks, and you know, I'm an untreated alcoholic is what it really is. And I ended up going to the doctors and getting on pills, and I couldn't wait, man. I couldn't wait because I was going crazy. I was crazier. Now I'm going just absolutely crazier. I don't have God in my life. I'm not even around you people. I dropped you people years ago. You bored me to tears. You know, all you were doing was talking about just not drinking. I can just not drink. You know, that's my experience with AA. I can just not drink. I don't need you guys to tell me that. And that was arrogant, I know, because obviously I couldn't. So I got on pills, and of course you know what happened. I actually started dating, and the guy knew I didn't drink, and he drank, and I was cool with that. And you know how it talks about in the big book, you won't be able to bring to consciousness the memory of your last drink. Not only could I not bring it to memory, but I didn't even want to drink. I didn't even want to drink. And I sat in a bar and ordered a dark beer. And I remember the guy saying, I thought you didn't drink. And I said, oh, I don't drink, but I've never had a dark beer before. Because I quit before dark beer. I quit before they had dark beer. So see, that made sense to me. So I said, well, I don't drink, but I mean, man, it is insidious. You know, it is insidious if you're suffering from that malady. And I was off to the races, and I darn near killed myself again, flipped a couple cars. I guess towards the end, I had a experience where I went away with this guy that I was dating, who I ended up marrying, and I left him at the Bottle and the Cork and left with the band. Now, I'm not a young kid, you know what I mean? I leave with the band, I go with them, I'm drinking somewhere, I don't even know where I am. I'm driving home across the bridge, I fell asleep three times and hit the guardrail. I would not be standing here if it wasn't for God and the guardrail. And that didn't even stop me. I can remember saying, I'm a survivor. Oh, that was an adventure. Oh, what an adventure. You know, I like to live on the edge, that's an adventure. I know, you know what stopped me was God. I started having seizures, and I was falling down everywhere, in the bathroom, in the bookstore, in the grocery store, just walking along, boom. And I wasn't worried about the seizures. I was worried about who saw me when I was laying on the ground having the seizures. You know, and I was like, you know, looking around like frozen, like I wondered who saw me. Oh my God, did he see me? Oh my God, oh my. Never even dawned on me that, Paula, you are having seizures. You're losing time. You know, it was bad. I know that now. Anyhow, I remember falling in my house, and I had like a case of beer in the garage, and I mean, everything was falling apart. My parents were starting to realize I was drinking. My brother was realizing I was drinking. I was losing time from work. It was really, really bad. I'm having these seizures. I fall down in my living room, and I remember scraping my elbow, and I remember saying, God, please help me. Now, I didn't even believe in God. I didn't believe in God. I'm an atheist. I'm not now, but I was. And I'm saying, God, please help me. Do you know I got up off of that rug, never thought twice about it, and never drank again. To this day, never drank again. Now, I called on a God that I don't even believe in that believed in me. Now, I know that today. After doing a set of steps, I realized that experience is pretty powerful. I didn't even get it then. I just realized that all of a sudden, the desire to drink had been completely removed, even with the case of beer sitting out in the garage, completely removed. Now, I'm still on all these pills, you know, antidepressants and lithium and Librium and Fiorisets and, you know, all that stuff. I got a headache. I need a Fiorisets. I'm reading the medical book. Oh, this is how I can get Valium. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. But anyhow, and so I never drank again, and long story short, my second husband and I ended up moving out to Colorado, and I think I was just ready to like kill him, kill myself, drink again, I'm not sure, but I've got about a couple years sober but I'm on all the medications. And I remember him saying, why don't you go to AA? And me looking at him, and I'm serious when I say this, and saying, why? I've done that before. I'm not drinking. And really thinking that. I'm not drinking. Why would I go to AA? Well, just go and see what they're doing there. Because he had a father that was an alcoholic. So I said, oh, okay, I'll go in fellowship. I'll go socialize. I don't like my husband anyway. This is what I'm thinking. I'll go and tell them people. I don't like my husband. That's what I thought AA was. Because, see, that's what I heard in 79. They were all talking about their husbands and their diseases and their... So I said, I'll go and tell... Oh, perfect. I'm going to go tell them about my husband. Because I like my first husband. I didn't like my second husband. So I go in there, and it's this huge group. I mean, big, huge meeting. A lot of Native Americans sitting there. It's just cool. And I remember... And they kind of raised their hand, and they were talking a little differently, but I didn't really notice it because I was all thinking about me. I wonder how I look. I wonder if my hair looks good. Did I put enough makeup on? That guy looks cute. You know, I'm thinking all this kind of stuff. And I remember raising my hand and saying, hi, I'm Paula. I have 17 years. Now, that was the first time. I didn't tell them about how I drank in between. And I'm like, hi, I'm Paula. I have 17 years. And I don't like my second husband. I think I'm out of love with him, and I don't know what to do. Because that's what I heard. I hate to say it, but that's what I heard. Not you people, but that's what I heard somebody say somewhere along the line. So I put my hand down. Dead silence. Oh, my God. And I thought, wow. And nobody, like, cross-talked or offered to solve my problem. Like, they just acted like I never even said anything. But afterwards, you know how, like, sometimes, like, guys will surround the girls, like, in band meetings, and the girls will surround the guys, you know, like, in the band meetings? None of the guys came up to me. All the girls came up to me. And I'm like, this is kind of boring. And like, I just didn't get it. I didn't get it. And all the girls kept saying, did you do the steps? And I'm like, well, I went to a rehab. And, no, did you do the steps? And, like, I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know what they meant. I honestly didn't know. And I said, well, and I pointed to the wall, and I said, yeah, I think I did the steps. And they said, well, this one guy came up, Chuck, and he said, Paula, this is Meg. Meg, this is Paula. Meg's going to be taking you through the steps. They assigned me a sponsor. I'm like, oh my God. I didn't even know that's what she was, to tell you the truth. But anyhow, I'm like, and fun. I want to be with Chuck. Chuck's kind of cute. So I'm like following Chuck around, you know, like a little robot. Oh, God. Thank God for the good guys in AA. And there are some, because, I mean, those meetings I went to proved it. They really did. I was looking for excitement. I'm looking for all the wrong things. I don't know what the hell I'm looking for. Oh, sorry. Oh, we're taping this, too. At least I didn't say the F word. I've played that a lot lately. Anyhow, I guess, you know, human. And I kept going to the meeting, and Meg kept coming up to me, and I noticed that all the other people there had done the steps, and they were talking about them, and I wanted to be a part. I wanted to be a part of that. So I only did the steps because I wanted to fit in. You know, like, whereas with the other groups, there were no steps, and we were just fitting in by fellowshipping. This group was all together talking about steps and spiritual experiences, and they were talking about the Creator, and like I said, a lot of Native Americans, so they're talking about Wonkantanka and Tumkushula and the Red Road, and that was, like, kind of exciting. I thought, well, this guy, you know, sounds kind of cool. So I sat with her, and the first time I showed up late, and, you know, I had my Range Rover out in the driveway, and I pull up, and she's in the basement of somebody's house, and I'm thinking, oh, this is, like, really lower class here. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm wearing this, like, full-length black mink coat. Oh, my God, what a scene that was. Of course, you know, later on I'm facing foreclosure, bankruptcy. It's all going, but I'm going to dress like this and act like that just to, you know, impress you guys, you know. And I remember pulling up late and her saying, you can leave. My time is valuable. And if you're, you know, you want to be serious about the steps, come back, but you're not going to show up 15 minutes late. And I was like, oh, my God. And so I left. And then I came back the next time, and I was on time. She knew how to treat me. And she wasn't mean. She wasn't mean. It was just, I don't know. I don't want to put labels and names on what she was doing. It was God. God was working through her, and he knew what I needed. Let's just say it that simply. You know, and it might sound mean, but there was nothing mean about her. It was all love. Nothing mean about her. I remember sitting there and going through the steps with her, And I remember looking up at her, and she had these really dark black eyes. She was a Lakota Indian. And I remember her looking up at me and saying, "You are the saddest person I have ever worked with in my entire life." And me thinking, oh my God, no one had ever said that to me before. I thought I was the only one that knew that. I didn't know she knew that and other people could say it. This meeting was real. These people were real. And they had done the steps, and they just knew. They knew that emptiness. Here I'm thinking I'm hiding it, and I'm not. Anyhow, she took me through the steps, and then she relapsed in between the third and fourth step. And she gave me directions, and I never saw her again. She had a few years, and she definitely had a light in her eye when she was working with me. And I know God put her in my life for a reason. Everything I said to her, she just had an answer, and it made sense. You know, even when we were reading, like, Bill Wilson's story, and I said, oh, this is so boring, she looked up at me and said, well, what's the first page say about loneliness? You look lonely. You look like you're always fancying things, and you're living in unreality or lack of reality or whatever you want to call it. She just knew what to say all the time. And God really used her. She talked to me about powerlessness, but it wasn't the don't drink, once you pick it up, you can't stop. It was none of that stuff. I'd learned all that in the rehab. That didn't keep me away from alcohol. She talked about it from the viewpoint of not having the Creator run my life, not having a very good manager, me, the manager, and look what I had done with my life. She talked about the powerlessness from that standpoint, about needing something else to run my life. You know, that I was an untreated alcoholic suffering from alcoholism. And I had never, ever, ever heard anybody say it like that before. I never heard anybody say that, ever. The bad news for me was, when she talked about that, I said, fine, okay. And then she said, you need God. And I'm like, whoa, you don't understand. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I'm God. That's what I said to her. I'm God. And she said, that's been working for you pretty well, hasn't it? Like, she just cut me to the quick. You know, everything I said. But I just stood there in my arrogance and my false pride with my ego, my mind in charge, and I couldn't let my heart speak. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't believe in God. If you had told me anything else, I might be okay. But I don't believe in God. I thought I was scientific. I'm so smart. You know, I'm brilliant. I'm a scientist. Anyhow, she said, I'm sorry, I can't work with you. She said, I'm sorry, I can't work with you. And I know I talked about three and four, but I kind of forgot this is probably the most important part of my life was this part here. But she said she couldn't work with me, and she sent me away. And I said, right before I left her house, I said, is there anything I can do? I was desperate, and yet not desperate enough to say, I'll buy your God, or I'll be willing, or none of that. I wouldn't do that. I would not let myself do that. I said, is there anything I can do? She said, well, you can read We Agnostics. Read it a couple times, see if it fits in your heart. But I'm not going to lie to you, this is about a power outside of yourself. You're not a good manager, and you need another manager. She said, that's what a malaise is. That's what a malady is. She said, you're disconnected from the Creator. So I left, and I felt bad, and I was scared. I was terrified. And I remember reading We Agnostics, and just reading it over and over and over again. And there's like a line in the back of the book that says, who are you, in the back of that chapter that says, who are you to say there is no God? And I remember almost falling to the ground with that line, thinking, who am I to say there is no God? And I remember it was saying in that chapter something about people of great intelligence who believed in God, people who have had great tragedies, people taken from them, horrifying, hard lives, and they still believed in a power out there and still trusted that power. And I don't know, that was enough for me. It was enough for me to have that line kind of going across my forehead, who are you to say there is no God? Because I kept thinking, who am I? Who am I? My husband's dead. My second marriage is falling apart. I'm facing foreclosure and bankruptcy. My kids hate me. I mean, I'm such a big phony, and she can say it, and I can say it. My life really just kind of sucks. So I went back, and I said to her, I think I can believe in it a little bit. And she started teaching me Native American principles. And see, that worked for me, because it was kind of not the Jesus thing, because I was mixing up religion and spirit, and now I'm okay with anything, I don't care, whatever way we get to God is fine, if not always. But then I want to eliminate anything that had to do with religion or Jesus or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. And I don't know why. My parents brought me up in a good Catholic home, and I mean, they didn't do anything to me that would make me feel that way. It was just my own arrogance, my own dark life that I had lived with alcohol and drugs, that I just didn't want to think that there was a maybe a God personal to me. But this Tankushala and Wonk and Tonkin worked for me, and that was enough to open the door. I did the steps with another girl, because like I said, Meg relapsed in between steps 3 and 4, and I ended up doing the steps with another woman, Joyce, and it was quick, you know, it was just thorough, it was in order. She wanted to get me to God, she wanted to get me to the power, she wanted to have me have a spiritual experience that's not sponsor dependent, but God dependent. But more importantly, what they were doing all around me was helping others. And I think she knew that if I didn't get active, I would go back into that self-centeredness again. And if I didn't start living the steps, not learning the steps, there's so many people today that sit around analyzing the words and all, and I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about big book studies. I'm not talking about analyzing the difference between this word and that word. We never did that. And what she wanted to do was get a spiritual experience for me so I could start helping other girls. And that's what happened. Joyce gave me that spiritual experience through finishing the steps. My marriage was falling apart. Everything was falling apart around me. And I was starting to, like, collapse again. And so I was hanging around this group, and they kept dragging me to these meetings, introducing me to people. Paula, this is, this girl's name was Meg, too. Paula, this is Meg. Meg, this is Paula. Meg, Paula's going to be your sponsor. They were doing the same thing to me. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't do this. I'm not qualified. I don't have enough time. You know, and that's the kind of thoughts that were going through my mind. But there, it was just something you did. Like, right away, they looked at me like I was nuts. Like, you don't have a choice. This is a solution. You know, it isn't about learning. Faith without works is dead. You know, that's what I know today. It's kind of my mantra today is faith without works is dead. But I got a really great beginning and a really great start for that my second time in AA in Colorado. So I did. I started helping people, and all around me, bad things were happening. Divorce, lawsuits, landslide litigation. I came 2 weeks away from foreclosure, bankruptcy. My dad was dying in Delaware from brain cancer. And I kept going to meetings and helping people, working with people. Not going to meetings and sitting there. Going to meetings to find people to help. And it really works. It really works. One of my favorite parts in the big book is on page 14 and 15. I'm not a big book quoter and I'm not a studier, but it talks about Bill Wilson, and he's new and he's just had a spiritual experience like I had. And it was directed from Eddie that he go and help people right away. And he did that. And it got him through the trials, I think the word was trials and tribulations, of that first year. And that was my foundation, getting through those trials and tribulations through helping others. And it talks about destruction of self-centeredness. And that's what was happening for me. It was destruction of self. My mind is crazy. It's still kind of nutty, if I believe it. And so what I was learning wasn't to trust my mind. I was learning to trust my heart, that smaller voice. You know, that small That small voice, what I have discovered is the voice that says, go to Jeff's group and speak. And the other voice that's louder and larger says, no, don't do that. They don't want to hear you. You're not good enough. You'll make a fool of yourself. That's my mind. I've learned to not trust the mind that tells me not to do it. And the tiny little voice is the God voice, and that's the heart voice that tells me to stand up here and to just walk through my fears. You know, and I've learned to trust that through helping others, not through studying, but through right away helping other people. And so that's what I did, and that's what Bill Wilson did. And the same thing happened to me. Like, if you guys remember the history, 6 months later, Bill Wilson wanted to drink. He had a white light experience, and he wanted to drink. So if you think having a spiritual experience or a white light experience is going to work forever and for good and for all, it didn't for him. He went and found Dr. Bob. He didn't go to call somebody to talk about himself. You know, if you read the history in our book, you know, he didn't say, let me go to a meeting somebody and tell them about my problems. He called to look for Dr. Bob. So that has worked for me. That's what was pointed out for me to do, was to call people, find people to help. Not go sit in a chair because I earned it, you know, not go raise my hand and tell my personal problems, but walk in a meeting and look at you guys, not think of me and say, I wonder who needs some help. Now, I'm not a saint. I've only done this because it's worked so well. I did it because I had to, and then I was getting really good results from it. And then I really wanted to do it because it was bringing great joy. I mean, my dad is dying from cancer. I'm back in Delaware now. I've moved back from Colorado. I lost everything. I'm living with my mother, my four cats, my two kids, and I'm in my 40s living with my mother. And I'm liking it. I'm liking it. And my father is dying from brain cancer. And I'm the only one there that is able to work with him. We got people all around going crazy. It's the best they could do, but the principles, you guys, the Alcoholics Anonymous principles, which are ageless and timeless, come from great faith, come from God himself, were working for me like nothing else. And so I'm working with my dad, and he's getting, you know, he's going into comas, and my mother is doing, just to give you an example, my mother, God love her, she's tying him up in a chair. He's almost dead. She's tying him up in a chair on the hopes that if he sits up straight in a chair and watches Family Feud, it'll stimulate his mind, his brain, and he's going to be okay. See, she can't accept it. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of the principles, and because I had such a big God in my heart, not only can I accept it, but I can be there for him, and I can say to my mom, Mom, why don't you go out? And then I untie him. And I untied him, and I let him slump and sit and do whatever he wanted. And I remember him coming to and saying, Paula, I don't want to sit in this chair. Can you put me over here? And I would get him up and drag him in this chair. I hope I'm not depressing you. This is just so much in my heart. It makes me feel so good to share this. But I'm moving my dad all around. It's such a good memory for me. I'm sitting him in this chair and that chair, and we're laughing. Like 2 days later, he went into a full-time coma. But I remember looking at him and thinking, this is it. This is me and my father. And my mother can't accept it. Because of you guys, and because of God, and because of the principles, not only could I accept it, but I could love him. I knew he was dying, and I could do whatever he wanted. And I didn't think of me. I didn't think of me. And everybody else around me is thinking of me. They're thinking of them. That doesn't make them bad people. It's just they don't have what we have, this 12-step program to God. It's powerful. It'll get you through anything. So that was a beautiful experience for me. I don't know where I was, what I was doing there, but anyhow. practicing 12 step, I guess. I just skipped them all and went right to the 12th. That's my favorite. Anyhow. An odd thing happened to me. moving from Colorado to Delaware and living in my mom's house, and things on the outside got better, but I could have cared less about that. Inside, I was feeling pretty good. But I was going into meetings, and this was back in 2001, and there were no big books, and there were all like open discussion meetings, and I would walk in like this because this is how I was taught. You know, you go to church, you bring your Bible. You go to AA, you bring your book. So I bring my book everywhere. So I walk in with my book in my hand, and people are looking at me like, I mean, I'm not kidding you when I say they're staring at me. I put my book on the table, and I look around. Nobody else has a book on the table. It's weird. I don't know. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't understand it. And they're, again, talking about crazy stuff every meeting I went into. And so I could never find a topic to talk about because I didn't. You know how sometimes it's hard, like you're trying to pull out what step or what experience or how can I talk about God? And so I would just start talking about God and the steps. Silence, dead silence. It was horrifying. So every meeting I went into, I would carry the book, talk about the steps, and it was always dead silence. But you know what's happening? People were being attracted to it. And it was just like the book talks about, like a fellowship will grow up around you. A fellowship was growing up around me, and people were coming up to me, and they were saying, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Delaware. But I was in Colorado, but I'm from Delaware. And they're like, well, the steps, the way you talk about the steps. I'm like, I've just been through the steps, haven't you? And I started taking people through the steps, and it was powerful. And it was just the most amazing experience. And little groups were coming up around me. But I didn't have a sponsor. And everybody that I would ask, no, we're too busy. No, I already have three girls. Here, you can call me in about 6 months. And I had never heard that before. I mean, that's not... I mean, I'm serious. So I'm thinking, what am I supposed to do? No women are coming. You know, nobody can sponsor me. They're all turning me down. So I go up to this one guy, this old black guy, and he was always talking about the steps. So I said, can you be my sponsor? I don't know, guy, girl, who cares? So he became my sponsor, and he was wonderful. And come to find out, he was sponsoring a lot of women in our area because the women weren't doing it. The women weren't doing it. Not to make the women feel guilty, but we really need to step up our game. That's what I have discovered. And the funny thing about it is, and I don't want to make anybody feel bad or guilty, but I almost was the only woman sponsoring in the entire state of Delaware in 2001, and I'm not saying that because I'm a big shot. I'm not saying that for that, because now there's so many, we're fighting over girls to help. We're fighting to try to get the girls to work with them. But to think that so many women were so busy, you know, had the busies. Oh, I'm raising my kids. Oh, I got my husband. Oh, I got to do this. I'm raising two kids on my own, working full time, going to school, and God has allowed me to have this full AA life also. And I think because I put AA and you guys first, it's why I have such a blessed life, not the other way around. Like, I learned that from my first experience in AA. My first experience in AA, I was chasing all the other powers, and I did have the busies. So I kept trying to share that with women. I kept trying to say, well, let me just tell you what happened when I got the busies. And like one by one, a lot of those women went back out and drank again. And then they came back in, and then they got real busy. And so it's been a neat thing to watch the state of Delaware grow and grow with podium meetings. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Acts of Recovery, but I immediately went to them in 2001 because I didn't have any friends, and so I didn't know what to do. I didn't have anybody to talk to with or anything about the steps, but I saw a flyer for the Acts of Recovery, and it was in Virginia, and I remember I drove by myself. It was about 3 hours, and I met Sammy Griffin. You guys might know her, and Tom Flynn and Steve and a whole bunch of people, and what camaraderie and fellowship. But I had to drive for it. And I didn't care. I drove everywhere. I went all over to Baltimore and just, I had to. Because it wasn't around me, but it was coming up. It was coming up and it was growing. And today, I am back in college. I'm 53 years old. I work full time. And I'm taking a business degree at the University of Delaware. My mother has Alzheimer's. My aunt has Alzheimer's. And my biggest fear is I'm going to have Alzheimer's. And I prayed and I prayed. And I said, God, help me. just God help me. Do something for me, because I feel like maybe I'm going to have Alzheimer's. I don't know. I mean, it might sound funny, but I don't know. And I got a job at the University of Delaware. And my daughter is going to the University of Delaware for free. I'm going to the University of Delaware for free. Now my third daughter is going to the University of Delaware for free. So if you don't think God answers your prayers, try it. Just try it. Ask Him. He will answer your prayers. I'm specific. One of the big followers that I follow, I didn't say that quite right, but one of the books that I read a lot is Emmett Fox. And Emmett Fox has this thing where he says, practice the presence of prayer. You know, God is good. God will answer your prayers. God will do anything you want. He will, anything you want, if you ask and you believe. And I've done that. Now, I'm not asking for the husband. I'm not asking for the Mercedes. I'm just asking for what God would have me be. Show me what you would have me be. Put me on a path. And a lot of times it's not quite the path that I think he's given me. It's not the answer. I don't think it's the answer. Like, I've worked at the University of Delaware, and I could have got a free education like a couple years ago. I could have started. And I was getting this deep thing in my heart that you should be doing this, you should be doing this. But I was fighting it. Now I'm going to go do this. Now I'm going to go do that. I can't do it. I'm not smart enough. But I kept getting this, when I was praying, this answer. You're supposed to be going to school, Paula. Look what I've given you. I've given you the opportunity for you and your two children. And I kept feeling this in my heart, but I was full of fear again. The fear cripples me. It runs my life. I can't have that. So now I'm in school. So all day I'm studying economics. I can't stand economics. It's so hard. It's just so hard. I mean, I just, you know, now it's getting in these linear equations. But I'm doing it. I'm going to do it. Because God's going to do it for me. And maybe I'll just get a C, but I'm going to pass it. I feel that in my heart I can do it because of God. I know I can do anything because of God. And that's because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's because I'm not working on me anymore. When I start going back and working on me again, I don't get good results. You know, I start just feeling disconnected and hyper and discontent and irritated. And then I have to look at how active am I. It's really simple for me. It usually comes down to one question. How many girls are you working with? That's it. I have alcoholism. How many people am I working with? It's so simple. You know, I've tried other things in the past. It's just that easy for me. I don't want to make it any more complicated. I usually go in a meeting. I'll say, God, please put somebody in my path. I need to get out of me. And He'll give me somebody. And I'm full of joy again. So it's working for me. How many people am I working with? That's it. It's that simple. And my untreated alcoholism comes back really quickly when I'm not doing the treatment. So, I mean, I think the answer is so simple. And yet it took me years to get there. And I think I'm done, Jeff. Thanks.